Many people think being a Christian is the most boring life possible. They say, all Christians do is go to church, read an outdated, dusty book, and say no to anything fun. Many people actually feel sorry for you if you're a Christian. One writer notes, is a Christian life supposed to be boring? Well, not when it's lived correctly. Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and have it to the full. There are pitfalls and things are not always rosy. Spiritual attack is a very real thing. Christians experience depression and sorrow and misery just like other people. But when a Christian is living in truth and seeking the kingdom of God and the salvation of souls, boring is the last thing his or her life will be. Now, do you think these contradict enjoying life and having a fear of God? Do you think someone can both love life and love God? Do we have to choose between fun and obedience? Well, it's helpful to hear from somebody who's done it all, especially when God inspires his words. And of course, I'm talking about King Solomon. Now, most see Solomon as having written Song of Songs in his young life and then Proverbs in midlife. And now, as an old man who has seen it all, he muses on the meaning of life in Ecclesiastes. Now, in our age, people idolize athletes or attractive people who pretend to be someone else. You know what I'm talking about, right? Hollywood, Bollywood. But back in Solomon's time, sages were idolized and taught wisdom, as people then seemed to pursue wisdom more than they do today. And we have his wisdom here. And that's back to our question. How can we be intentional to enjoy life and fear God? These are not mutually exclusive. You can do both and should do both. And the Bible presents both the ideals of life and also the realities. In many ways, Proverbs gives the ideals and Ecclesiastes gives the exceptions to those ideals. Many of us think that, well, we cannot both enjoy life and fear God in the midst of the uncertainties and fleeting nature of life. But Solomon shows that actually all of these work fine together. Since our life is short and perplexing, we can and should both enjoy life and fear God. In fact, the very fear of God is what makes us best enjoy life. So today we're going to see four reasons to be intentional to do both. And here's the first reason to be intentional to enjoy life and to fear God. It's because, well, we need to live as if life is fleeting. This is the first way we can be intentional. This is basically the idea of even the oldest people don't live very long. You know, life's short-lived and fleeting. Cycles should move us to seek God. What we'll find as we go through the book is that this book actually breaks down pretty evenly or nicely into four main sections under the theme, work and wisdom don't last. And in these first 11 verses, we find Solomon giving us the theme of the book about the fleeting nature of man's humanity. He talks about these cycles in life when we get into the first chapter. I call this going in circles. It's like, why do we run so fast? Rats often run in circles. People do as well. And it seems like so many people are just trying to climb the ladder to the top. You know what I'm talking about? Or some have said it in terms of the rat race. You ever feel like you're running the rat race? Do you know what happens when you win the rat race? You're still a rat. And I know some of you are saying, oh, yeah, but if you only knew my boss, then you'd know why I'm running so fast. But what we find in this book is that every human endeavor is short-lived. I think that's really the idea of verse 2. The King James Version says this is vanity of vanities. But the word here, hevel, the Hebrew word, is actually a very multifaceted word. In some ways, we could say it's vanity. King James and the ESV and the New American Updated Version call it vanity. Other translations use the term meaningless or futile. That's basically what we've got with the NET Bible and the Living Bible. Even the Bible Knowledge Commentary notes that. I think there's some, you know, some possibility that these ideas can be seen in certain ways, but I really don't think those are the best translations for it. I think if you have to really choose one word, then the best word to describe what hevel actually means is the word fleeting. In other words, everything just goes by so fast. That's what we actually find in this. I think this is really the key word of Ecclesiastes. And honestly, I've wrestled with how to actually understand this word and understand this book. Now, I used to see the book as if Solomon was like, he was underwater most of the time, declaring life to be meaningless. And why does he say it's meaningless? He's seeing life only like under the sun in a horizontal perspective. He's only looking at life from a human view. And then at various points, it's like he comes up from air, out of the water, and he says, no, but enjoy life. And also, fear God, says this a few times in the book. And then his conclusion tells us to also keep his commandments. Fear God and keep his commandments. The last couple verses of the book. But is that the right way to look at the book? I used to call this the meaninglessness of human achievement and wisdom. But actually, is life really meaningless? Do you think it's meaningless? I mean, was Solomon schizo? Was he just going through the book back and forth, contradicting himself? Well, it can be helpful to look at the literal meaning of hevel. This is what it literally means: a breath, wind, or vapor. We see the word used in Proverbs and Isaiah. So if you want a very literal translation of the book, it's like you got to look at me and you've got to see the breath coming out of my mouth. Here's a literal translation. Says the preacher. Everything is... Now you can't even see the breath coming out. And that's the point. This is a metaphor for what doesn't last. What's without real substance or value or permanence or significance or meaning, is the way the Bible Knowledge Commentary puts it. Now, but if you think about it, wind or vapor, I mean, it's not meaningless. It does have some substance, but just doesn't last very long, does it? The vapor or the breath is fleeting. It's transitory. In some ways, it's enigmatic or perplexing. Because we kind of wonder, well, where'd that breath go? And life is kind of like that. Life is also unseen and obscure in terms of when we're trying to figure things out. I think that's the idea of chapter 11, verse 8, when the word hevel is used. Some synonyms for this word might be fleeting, passing, brief. He's saying that life's temporary. Things are just momentary, transitory. Everything seems to be short-lived. And he gives illustrations of this. Life's many cycles are passing. He asks the question, well, what do people get for all their hard work under the sun? And this question he asks in verse 3, he answers. He says, basically, our work ultimately brings us nowhere. And he seeks to prove that life's many fleeting repetitions, they really don't bring any change. You see ceaseless cycles evident in our generations. He says in verse 4, generations come, generations go, but the earth remains forever. I mean, think about it. The fertilized egg becomes a fetus, and then a baby, and a child, an adolescent, adult, old age, and we end up in the grave. And it cycles again and again and again with other people. We see these ceaseless cycles in nature as well. He says in verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The NIV has it. I think that's a good translation. It's like the sun is getting out of breath. Yeah. And the same for the wind. The wind just, blows in circles. Nobody actually sees where it comes from, where it goes. And you see the same thing with water. All the streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again, verse 7 says. We know that water evaporates and condenses in the air and comes down in precipitation and runs off and just does this over and over again. And so I'll jump to verse 9. He says, nothing under the sun is truly new. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. He doesn't mean there's never a new invention. He just means that life continues to have all of these cycles. I think the main idea of this basically is life's short-lived and fleeting. Cycles should move us to seek God. So how do you deal with the fact that life is short-lived? I'm bringing in the end of the book where he says, fear God and keep his commandments, because if you only take these 11 verses themselves, then I think you'll just misinterpret what he's actually saying. He's basically saying, don't get caught up in the race. Don't get caught up in the rat race doing everything. Think more deeply. I like the way Francis Chan puts it. Our greatest fear should not be failure, but succeeding in the things that in life that really don't matter. So many of us are a success at what will ultimately fail. So how can we do both? How can we be intentional to enjoy life and fear God? How can we? Well, we need to live as if life is fleeting. But then he goes on and he starts talking about something quite relevant, frankly, to all of us, and that's our work. Not only is life fleeting, well, certainly then, by implication, you'd say that work is fleeting. And we need to live as if work is indeed fleeting. All the human endeavor, whatever we do with our hands, ultimately is not going to last. That doesn't mean don't go to work. He just means that there's a lot of profitless pursuits, and he highlights that as we continue on in verse 12, where he says, I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. Wow. As king, he had opportunity to pursue just about everything, all kinds of crazy things. Sort of reminds me of Howard Hughes. Maybe you've heard of Hughes, who died in 1976. He was an American businessman, investor, aviator, aerospace engineer, filmmaker, and philanthropist. He was one of the wealthiest people in the world. In fact, my father-in-law worked for Hughes Aircraft Company as an accountant. He's best known for his interest in aviation. And his company sought to help the World War II effort by making the largest plane in history, the H-4 Hercules. Just an absolutely humongous plane designed to transport 700 troops across the Atlantic. Well, Hughes was so wealthy, he could afford just about any woman. And he dated many famous women, including Billy Dove, Betty Davis, Ava Gardner, Olivia de Havilland, Katharine Hepburn, Ginger Rogers, Jean Tierney, Jane Fontaine. He proposed to her several times, but she would never marry him. So how would a man like Hughes, who had enough money to do just about anything his heart desired and had all kinds of women in his life, how would he end? Well, his obsessive compulsive behavior plagued him in his later years. And in 1966, Hughes arrived in Las Vegas by railroad car. Interesting. He didn't even fly, even though he owned an airline. And he basically moved in to the Desert Inn. I mean, he refused to leave the hotel, and so to avoid further conflicts with the owners, he just bought the Desert Inn. And he spent most of his days living alone, naked, in his penthouse, watching movies. He watched one movie 150 times. In fact, his reclusive activities and maybe his drug use made him practically unrecognizable. His hair, beard, fingernails, toenails were long, possibly caused by a disease making him adverse to touch. And his tall 6'4", you know, that's 193 centimeters. His frame weighed barely 90 pounds, 41 kg. That's what Wikipedia says. He had a fixation on Kleenex boxes that he kept everywhere to keep from collecting germs. And that's how he lived the last 10 years of his life, dying in 1976. In fact, the FBI had to resort to fingerprints to identify the body. X-rays revealed 5 broken off hypodermic needles in the flesh of his arms. What a sad end, huh? Well, what are the profitless pursuits that we should avoid? I think we can take some great advice from the teacher. The king of Israel, verse 12 says. You know, he was the king during Israel's golden age, the wealthiest, most expansive time Israel's ever known. Well, he says, it's all fleeting. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really it's all meaningless, like chasing the wind, verse 14 says. So I call this profitless pursuits under the sun. And in this section of the book, he gives 5 of them. Let me just review them for you very quickly. Prudence doesn't satisfy. It's a profitless pursuit. He said in verse 16, look, I'm wiser than any of the kings who ruled in Jerusalem before me. And he says, I try to learn all these kind of things. And look at verse 18. The greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge only increases sorrow. Hey, here was a man who was unsurpassed by anybody of his time, or perhaps anyone in history. And yet, when he achieved wisdom, it only came with mental grief, emotional pain. So he tried pleasure. He said, so I thought in my heart, chapter 2, verse 1, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what's good. And he found humor not ultimately satisfying. pleasure in wine, verse 3. Pleasure in foolishness. You know, I embrace folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. And it didn't satisfy. He turned his attention to projects then. I undertook great projects, he says in verse 4. I built houses for myself and vineyards for myself, gardens and parks, and I planted all kinds of things in them. He said, I had food production and I built irrigation ponds for myself. He uses that phrase over and over. I did all these things, and it wasn't satisfying. Same with possessions. They don't satisfy either. He had numerous servants or slaves, people. He possessed more flocks and herds than anyone in Israel's history. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. He said, I had incalculable money. I amassed silver and gold for myself, verse 8. Wow. He had musicians, male and female singers, and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of a man. He had a harem for all his sexual desires, and it was just a possession in his mind. It didn't satisfy. Power also didn't satisfy for him. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. And all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Greatness doesn't satisfy. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I'd worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There's nothing really worthwhile anywhere. What's he actually saying? What's he concluding? He's basically saying our pursuits never profit. You take prudence, pleasure, projects, possessions, power. There's actually nothing wrong with any of these five. But Solomon found the same thing that Howard Hughes found, that they ultimately do not satisfy, which raises a question for you and me. What will it really take for you to be really satisfied? You know, we might say, well, if I just had more free time, then I think I would be happier. Or you may be thinking, well, a little bit more money might really help in the satisfaction department. Or, wow, if only so-and-so changed, well, I'd be happy. Really? Well, since work is fleeting, what we need to do is trust God's timing. Enjoy life. And enjoy God. He goes on to say that a man can do nothing better than eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. Chapter 2, verse 24. Isn't that great? Our to-do list at work never ends. So relax in God's plan. Trust his open doors and live with a sense of his blessing. When we get into chapter 3, we see him start talking about time, timing, if you will. And he tells us in these first 8 verses that God's timing is perfect. He causes events at the flawless moment. His thesis here is that every activity has its appointed time. There's a time for everything, he says here, and a season for every activity under heaven. What does he mean by that? He means that God's ways are perfect. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot, a time to kill, a time to heal. Over and over, he talks about all these things that are appropriate by God but only in their time. And then he says in verse 9, what do people really get for all their hard work? I've seen the burden God has placed on us all. I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. Life really can be a burden. And yet, look at verse 11. And yet God has made everything beautiful for its own time. Beautiful has the idea of appropriate, of fitting. The Hebrew literally reads beautiful, but the idea is more properly that God has made things right in His timing, not in ours. And you know, a lot of times we could say, well, at least if I know this or that, then life will make sense. But I think the main idea of Ecclesiastes 3, when you read the rest of the chapter here, we don't have time for, is to celebrate your ignorance of God's timing. Should we celebrate our knowledge? Yeah, it's great that you know certain things. But you should also celebrate your ignorance as well. And place your life in the hands of God. He says God's timing is perfect, God's ways are perfect. And so he concludes chapter 3 by saying, hey, enjoy life and fear God. At least he concludes this section of chapter 3. He says in verse 15, whatever is has already been, whatever will be has already been before, and God will call the past to account. So rest. And yet we see unfairness going on. And we often ask this question of what to do when life is unfair. So he addresses that also in this chapter. And he says, when you think that life is unfair, the first thing you should do is realize that you will account to God. I mean, it's easy to look at the injustices that other people are guilty of, but when it all comes down to it, the real issue is you. What do you do? Do you cause injustice? He sees injustice in the place where there's supposed to be justice. The Department of Justice, which is often the Department of Injustice. And then he says in verse 17, but God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked. Friend, that includes you and me. So, but rather than getting all upset that there really isn't any justice, he advises in verses 18 to 22, enjoy life now. You know, death is going to come, right? You're going to die. I'm going to die. Our fate is like the animals in that we will all die, verse 19 says. We'll all go to the same place, that is death, the dust. And so how does he conclude? He says, enjoy life. I saw there's nothing better for a man than enjoy his work, because that's his lot, for who can bring him to see what will happen after him. The main idea here is, what should you do when life is unfair? Account to God and enjoy life. Don't get caught up, as chapter 4 says, in just the workaholic woes. Now, why should we avoid being a workaholic? Are you a workaholic? If so, here's the section for you. He goes and gives us 16 verses in chapter 4, why we should not be a workaholic. Number one, if you're a workaholic, you don't get any comforters. He says, chapter 4, you know, I see all these people oppressed and they have no comforter. That's what happened when we don't balance life in terms of our perspective toward work. We also don't get any rest. He says, I saw in verse 4 all the labor and achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. And he says the fool folds his hands and ruins himself, but better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Don't worry about having two handfuls of everything. Toil, toil, toil without any rest. He says the workaholic also has no beneficiaries. He says there was a man all alone, verse 8, and he just was a workaholic, but for whom am I toiling, he asks? Why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? You know, you kind of get to the point, you say, well, why am I doing all this? Who's actually going to benefit from it? I deprive myself of pleasure so that other people can have pleasure with my money? Are you kidding? Workaholics don't have friends either. Two are better than one, he says in verse 9, because they have a good return for their labor. And he shares how it's such a blessing to have friends, but if you're a workaholic, you really don't have friends. You don't have time for friends. In fact, you don't even have followers, ultimately. Verse 13, better a poor but wise man than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. You know, and he says people can become king out of poverty, and then they end up doing the same thing. And there's no end to all the people who were before them. You know, people become so obsessed with work and power, but such people really don't have followers. So the main idea of chapter 4 is work at not becoming a workaholic. Work at it. It's probably something that's going to take some time, especially if you have patterns that really don't give God his priority. That's why he shifts in chapter 5 to talk about how to honor God. I find this quite a relevant question. You know, do you struggle worshiping God? You know, how can we actually honor God? Well, he gives two ways to do that, two ingredients of a true reverence for God. One is honor God in your worship. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen, rather offer the sacrifice of fools who don't know they do wrong. Don't be quick in your mouth, hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God's in heaven. You're on earth. So let your words be few. Well, that's really good. We need to ascribe worth to him in a way he accepts. He also says, you want to honor God? Do it in your vows. When you make a vow to God, verse 4 says, do not delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It's better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. Wow. He's basically saying, honor God in your worship and your vows. Two things we often really do not associate with, you know, with honoring God. Well, let me jump on over to chapter 6 and ask this question again. How can we do both enjoying life and fear God? How can we be intentional, which is really the title of this message, to enjoy life and fear God? We've seen here that the way you can do it is to live as if life is fleeting and live as if work is fleeting. But some of us might say, yeah, work is fleeting, that's true, but what about wisdom? I mean, you know, this is wisdom literature. If I really have wisdom, then things are gonna be great. I'm gonna live longer, I'm going to be able to enjoy life and fear God if I really have wisdom. Well, chapter 6, verse 10 to 11, 6, here's a big chunk of the book. It basically says that we need to live as if wisdom is fleeting. Because having the right answers is still not going to extend your life, having the greatest discernment is not going to solve all your problems. Because work doesn't last, but wisdom also doesn't last as well. And sometimes we can get caught up in thinking that if we just deal with our ignorance problem, man's head, as opposed to his heart, his hands that we just talked about, then things will be great. But this is a real shift in subject here to the third fleeting area in the book. And as we get into chapter 7, we see that man's ignorant. So he must rely upon the immutable and wise plan of God. We just don't know so many things. And we need to be people who focus on wisdom, yes. And he advises for wisdom, but wisdom is not as great as relying on God's immutable, wise plan. It's more of an issue of submission. And he especially talks about how wisdom is really practical and the signs of wisdom, especially in verses 15 to the end of the chapter. I like what Roy Zook says in regard to the practicality of wisdom and the signs of real wisdom. He says, biblical wisdom includes the art of being skillful and successful in one's relationships and responsibilities in life. An individual is successful as he directs his life in accord with God's divine design, his plans for the world. Kind of a different way of looking at wisdom, isn't it? Or success. We often talk about a person who is successful, but the relationships in his life are a mess. And we still call him successful because he has more money than other people. And in this section, we find three characteristics of wisdom that show us the qualities of wisdom. He says, first of all, that wisdom's balance. Balanced. Avoid the extremes of depending on righteousness and living in sin. We need to do neither. Depend on our righteousness and certainly not live in sin. He says here, in this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. So don't be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Wisdom is balance. Wisdom's also strong. Avoid the weakness from blindness to your own faults. We really can be blind to seeing ourselves correctly. Wisdom makes one man more powerful than 10 rulers in a city, verse 19 says. But he says, but there's not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. We should have the strength to recognize our own faults. If we don't, then we're weak. He also says wisdom's insightful. Avoid thinking you have all the answers, but still show insight. He says in verse 23, I determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. Whatever wisdom may be, it's far off and most profound. Who can discover it? Well, you know what? You can't completely. And he concludes the last verse of chapter 7, this only have I found. God made man upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. So we should have that wisdom. This chapter is telling us that wisdom's balanced, strong, and insightful, which makes us, you know, ask the question, is wisdom guarding me from extremes? Am I balanced in this regard? Is my wisdom strong? Is wisdom keeping me stable? And what about insight? Is wisdom clearing my mind to see reality? You know, I'm convinced we can't have Christ's wisdom without first having Christ. So my question for you is, do you know him? In what area of your life do you need balance, strength, or insight? Chapter 7 is telling us to identify it and ask God for his wisdom and courage to put wisdom to work. He's not arguing against wisdom. He's just saying wisdom has its limits. And this continues on as we go into chapter 8, where the issue is submission and joy. We don't normally link those two together, but that's the idea here. How should we respond to authority? You know, the authority of God and the authority of humans put over us. How should we respond to authority to both God and man? Well, he says we should obey authorities due to many advantages. I mean, he says obey the king, chapter 8, verse 2, because you took an oath before God. Wow. Obey the law. That is definitely an advantageous thing to do. That's a great way to respond to authority. But he also says we need to also recognize that we're to respond to authority, but we need to recognize that we punish the wrong people. And so it puzzles us. You know, he said, I saw the wicked buried, verse 10. Those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. Wicked people who go to church and everybody praises them. And then he talks about how important it is that we recognize, like in verse 14, that righteous men sometimes get what the wicked deserve and wicked men get what the righteous deserve. He says, this too I say is meaningless. I mean, you've seen it happen, right? He basically says we don't punish bad people in verses 10 to 13. Instead, we punish good people in verse 14. What? Well, you've probably seen it happen many times. So how do you respond to all that? He says, enjoy life and submit to God, even though he won't tell us his reasons. Wow. What advice. So I commend the enjoyment of life, he says in verse 15. Wow. He says, I recommend having fun. Amazing, huh? Because there's nothing better for people in this world than to eat, drink, and enjoy life. That way, they'll experience some happiness along with all the hard work that God gives them under the sun. Wow. Main idea of Ecclesiastes 8 is basically humbly submit to man and God, and then you'll get joy. You want joy? I really don't think it's going to come without submission. So where do you need to submit to authority? Where do you need to recognize your limited understanding? We all need to recognize this, and we all need to live lives of submission. Let other people be responsible to God. They will be for their actions. You be responsible for yours. Begins to look at the future when we get to chapter 9. And you know what's certain about the future? What is certain is that the future is uncertain. You know it's true. How do most people deal with our uncertain future? Well, we have our different strategies here. Some say, well, let's just buy as much as we can. That'll give us some security for an uncertain future. Some say, let's just spend as much as we can. Let's live it up now. Hedonism. Others say, we got to rely on all of our human efforts, humanism. And others say, oh, what the heck? That's fatalism. So how should you respond? How should I respond to an uncertain future? What he talks about in chapter 9 is the reality, our reality that we experience, and then our response. What is that reality? Here's your reality. Your uncertain future includes certain death. That's what you can be sure about, you can count on. He says, chapter 9, verse 2, all share a common destiny. Here are the, we really know nothing about what's going to happen to us except that we will die. I found it interesting to see this 75 years of mortality in the United States and see these charts about the mortality rate. And let's see, is it going up or is it going down? Well, here's the more accurate chart. This is the world mortality rate. 92 was 100%, 93, 100%, 94, 100%. That doesn't mean everybody dies every year, but what it means is that the mortality rate is constant. 100% of us die. So how do you respond to that? Verse 9 tells us, since you'll die, enjoy life and work hard now. Seriously. This is not fatalism. This is enjoying what God has given. So go ahead, verse 7 says, eat your food with joy, drink your wine with a happy heart, for God approves of this. He's essentially saying here in these first 10 verses of chapter 9, since you don't know the future, work hard and enjoy life. Don't let it deprive you. How about chapter 10? Well, what about wisdom? Why doesn't wisdom always lead to success? He's already said that. But why doesn't it do it? There's a few reasons that it doesn't lead to success. One of them is just that life is unfair. He says, chapter 9, verse 11, I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. And he goes on and he explains this whole chapter, on into chapter 10, concludes with verse 7, I've seen slaves on horseback while princes go on foot like slaves. You just can't figure it out because life has its inequities. And our existence doesn't have all accounts settled fairly yet. But wisdom recognizes this truth, that humanity is biased and inequitable. That's wise to recognize that. Otherwise, you can go crazy. Life's also not only unfair, but life is uncertain. Chapter 10, verse 8 to 11, talk about the uncertainty of life. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. It's true. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. You know, whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. Life is uncertain. So how do you respond? He says, don't trust wisdom. Trust God. Amen. And yet, what about the fools? Oh, you know what I'm talking about. A lot of times we don't really ever want to talk about fools. But we all have to deal with fools. We all know one. Actually, we've all been one. You've played the fool, haven't you? How do you deal with a fool when that fool is that other person? We all need to know how to deal with fools. There's plenty of them around. And my challenge in addressing this passage relevantly is to talk about fools without being foolish myself. It's good to have them described, first of all. So he gives a description of fools. If you want to know how to deal with a fool, you better know what they are like. So he says, verse 12 of chapter 10, words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. So look at the speech and the actions of a fool. Is that self-destructive? If so, you know the person's a fool. Because non-foolish people don't destroy themselves. And he says, fools not only speak, but they act in a way that ruins, especially ruins themselves and others. And then there's a warning here. Don't even privately criticize foolish authorities because, well, they may find out. Wise advice, so you don't play the fool, is in verse 20. Do not revile the king, even in your thoughts. And that would include your employer, your superior. Don't curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird of the air may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. So he says, you know, watch your tongue concerning your boss, or your tongue may bite you. Don't criticize your foolish leader, is essentially what he's saying here. Have you done that? Have you criticized a superior? You know, it takes little size to criticize, they say. Have you been critical of your church leaders, even in private? Do you quickly judge the decisions of your prime minister, or your president, or judges, government officials, other leaders? There's wisdom in not playing the fool by doing that. Chapter 11 continues in talking about the uncertain future. How does it actually affect you? How should your uncertain future influence you? So what do you do with the fact that you just don't know the future? He says, give generously and invest wisely. Both give and invest. He says, cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you'll find it again. The idea here in the NLT is maybe a little clearer. Send your grain across the seas, and in time profits will flow back to you. He's not saying waste bread. He's saying invest wisely, but divide your investments among many places, for you don't know what risks might lie ahead. So don't hoard, but give and invest, since you really don't know the future. And by the way, work hard due to your uncertain future. This is the point of verses 4 to 6. Don't stop working hard. He says, whoever watches the wind will not plan. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. Hey, you're going to always find an excuse. The wind could just, you know, tear something up, or the clouds could bring rain and stop you. Don't be looking at them. Just work. And the main idea of these first six verses is simply give generously, invest wisely, and work hard, since you don't know your future. So ignorance of the future should give us wisdom about money and work. So how can we do both? How can we enjoy life and fear God? We need to live as if life is fleeting, as if work is fleeting, as if wisdom is fleeting. And finally, we need to live as if youth is fleeting. You know why? Because it is. Youth does not last long. And he ends the book talking about man's heart aging. It's time to talk about how to enjoy your youth. You want to enjoy youth, right? Now, is that you, by the way? Are you a youth? How would you actually know you're a youth? What are the various stages of life? Well, tell me what stage you're in. Life basically has essentially three stages. For women, one person says that the three stages of life for women include, number one, annoying her dad, number two, annoying her husband, and number three, annoying her son-in-law. What a sad evaluation that is. Lest you think I'm just anti-woman, there's three stages for men, too. Number one, you believe in Santa. Stage two, you don't believe. Stage three, you are Santa. But seriously speaking, life, I think it does have three stages. At least for our purposes, I'll say for that your youth would be up to age 30, and midlife would be 30 to 60, and then The elderly would be 60 to 90. And he's really saying, what should you pursue during this time of your youth? He says, focus on two pursuits. Wow, that makes it simple, doesn't it? If you're a youth, here's the advice from the wisest man ever to live in Ecclesiastes 11:7 to 12:7. What he tells you is, enjoy life now before judgment and death comes. Hey, live each day with joy because you'll account for it. And actually, it might be your last. Light is sweet and it pleases the eye to see the sun. He says, however many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless. In other words, healthy as you are, enjoy your life, but you will get old. You know, he says here, also honor your Creator before you grow old and die. Do you get those two? Enjoy life, but honor your Creator. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, the New American says. Or the NLT, New Living Translation. Don't let the excitement of youth cause you to forget your Creator. Honor Him in your youth before you grow old and say, life's not pleasant anymore. That's pretty great advice, don't you think? He's telling us that we need to make sure that we do both. Chapter 12 concludes with the theme. Again, life is fleeting. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher. Completely meaningless. Sounds dismal, doesn't it? Maybe you're saying, can't you offer anything more positive than this today? I mean, if life's so short, then what value is there in listening to Solomon? But actually, I don't have anything of value to tell you except what God says in His Word. And by the way, His Word says that that's the authority. Live by God's words in your youth and all your days. Verses 9 and 10. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. Well, what is that? Well, the words of the wise are like goads, like little prods for an animal. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. You catch that? Man's books provide no ultimate answers and wear us out. So don't rely on books other than the words of the wise. Of making many books, there's no end, and much study wears you out. So then what should you read? Well, he's telling you, read the words of the wise. Read God's word. Know the Bible better than any other book. And the conclusion here is to respect and obey God because this applies to everyone. That's the whole story, verse 13 says. And here now is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey His commands. Why? Why should you fear God and obey His commands? For this is everyone's duty. Said differently, respect and obey God to finish well. So how can we do both? How can we enjoy life and fear God? Let's see if I can sum up the whole book that answers that question. Be intentional to live as if life is fleeting, including work, wisdom, and youth. All of them are fleeting. So live intentionally. Since life is brief, make the most of it by living for your Creator, and then you will be truly happy, content, joyful. I guarantee it. Live as if life is fleeting, work is fleeting, wisdom is fleeting, youth is fleeting. And he ends by saying, fear God and obey His commands. So what is your pursuit? What are you pursuing? Do you hunger for God's Word? You may read other books more than this book, but may I encourage you to read this book first? Make it your daily passion to get God's view on life before you get any other. Are you willing to tell God even right now that you'll read this book at least 5 minutes a day the rest of your life? That's 1/288th of each day of your life. Would you make a commitment that small? Lord, I pray that we would commit this to you and find that by knowing your word, we'll be able to fear you, keep your commands, and experience all that you want for us in life. Thank you for that. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.